Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau, of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Today it's becoming commonplace to declare that we live in the age of information. But more often it seems like the age of misinformation. Deception surrounds us everywhere, on TV, on the radio, in the newspaper, and on the internet. So writes our guest this week, Alex Berza, author of The Museum of Hoaxes. But if it makes us feel any better, Berza tells us that there is little new in this, that hoaxes have been around for millennia. Jonathan Coopersmith will also be joining us to offer some historical perspective on the debate over the future of the space program following the Columbia disaster. But first, Joey Skidmore takes us back to an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on June 13, 1872, some of the first Chinese to arrive on the East Coast marched, under police escort, through the entrance of Calvin Sampson's shoe factory in North Adams, Massachusetts. Sampson's factory was one of the largest shoe factories in the state, which was the center of the shoe industry. But the workers at Sampson's factory were angered by low wages and the growing threat of labor-saving machinery. They founded the Knights of St. Crispin Union and went on strike. And Sampson responded by hiring Chinese workers from San Francisco. The 75 young Chinese men faced a hostile reception from strikers and attracted national attention, but they soon settled quietly into their dormitory and worked their three-year contracts. It was a victory for Sampson. The union folded, and Sampson hired more Chinese workers. But growing anti-Chinese fears in America led to legislation limiting Chinese immigration and denying families of immigrants entrance to the U.S. And so, at the end of their contracts, many Chinese returned to their homeland. Some stayed, however, including one of the North Adams workers, Liu Gim Gong. Gong went to Florida, where he developed a hybrid of the Valencia orange and grew quite wealthy. A monument to Liu Gong stands in Sampson Hall, a building funded by his former employer, C.T. Sampson, on the campus of Stetson University.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, to the hundreds of slaves who took their first steps as free men and women there in antebellum days, the spot on downtown Cincinnati's riverfront, where the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center is rising, was sacred ground. But controversy surrounds the new building as well. To its backers, the Freedom Center will be an invaluable resource in telling the story of the Underground Railroad, the 1800s network of escape routes from the slaveholding South to the North. But to its critics, it's a case of misplaced priorities. Some call it a patronizing effort to paper over Cincinnati's deep-seated racial problems. "It's like building a new front porch while the house falls down," commented the Reverend Damon Lynch, head of the Cincinnati Black United Front, one of the groups that opposes the museum. They would prefer to use the money to revitalize poor inner-city neighborhoods, build affordable housing, and create new jobs. And Florence Nightingale may have suffered from a bipolar disorder, reports Kathy Wisner, a professor of psychology at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. Wisner made the case at an annual conference devoted to examining the supposed mental illnesses of some of history's major figures. Nightingale, the founder of modern nursing, gained her reputation during the Crimean War in the 1850s. When she returned to Britain, however, she was plagued for the rest of her life by insomnia, anorexia, anxiety, and depression. This is Talking History.
Ladies and gentlemen, due to circumstances beyond our control, we are unable to continue the broadcast from Grover's Mill. Evidently, there's some difficulty with our field transmission. However, we will return to that point at the earliest opportunity. In the meantime, we have a late bulletin from San Diego, California. Professor Indelkoffer, speaking at a dinner of the California Astronomical Society, expressed the opinion that the explosions on Mars are undoubtedly nothing more than severe volcanic disturbances on the surface of the planet. We continue now with our piano interlude.
Did you hear about how lemmings commit mass suicide by walking off the edge of a cliff? Or that Eskimos have 100 words for snow? Or that when Columbus sailed across the Atlantic in 1492, most Europeans thought that the Earth was flat? If you believe these well-known facts, you've been duped. They are, in fact, hoaxes. And our guest today is an authority on hoaxes. Alex Berza is a graduate student at the University of California at San Diego, and he has gathered dozens of hoaxes from the Middle Ages to the present in the Museum of Hoaxes, published by Dutton Books. Welcome, Alex.
Thanks, Brian. It's good to be here.
Well, it's good to have you. And let's start by defining a hoax. How does it differ, for example, from just plain deception, or does it?
Well, it really differs by degree. A hoax is a lie or an act of deception that is so sensational or outrageous that it's basically succeeded in attracting the attention of the public. So whereas a common garden variety lie, you know, you might tell to your friends, but it would never get published in a newspaper, a hoax is something so over the top that it would attract the attention of, say, a newspaper or the radio and get circulated in the public.
But it would be intentional and it would have a purpose, I would assume.
That's right. Hoaxes are always perpetrated purposefully, whereas they often get confused with urban legends, which are kind of rumors that are false, but they're not actually intentionally false, whereas a hoax is always that there's a conscious author behind it who has perpetrated it, you know, intending to deceive people.
Okay, that explanation implies, at least when I listen to it, and perhaps our listeners from the same situation, that it's a fairly contemporary phenomenon. But I think what's very interesting about your book is there's a whole history of hoaxes. Maybe you could tell us, what's the earliest hoax you discovered?
Well, actually, you can trace hoaxes far earlier than what I have in the book. In the book, the earliest hoax I include was the so-called Donation of Constantine, which was a hoax from, or rather an act of deception. They didn't use the word hoax before the 18th century. It was this deceptive act from the 8th century in which it was a document supposedly written by the Roman Emperor Constantine granting the Catholic Church vast territories within the Western Roman Empire. And supposedly the document was written in, you know, the 4th century when Constantine was alive, but it's actually been found to have been written in the 8th century. And it was a kind of way for the Catholic Church to legitimate this a union between the Catholic Church and the Frankish Empire. And the Frankish Empire was actually the political force that was giving those lands to the church. It had nothing to do with the Roman Emperor Constantine. But like I said, you can find very outrageous, deceptive acts far, far earlier. For instance, the Trojan Horse is a very famous act of deception from, you know, the Trojan Wars way back when. But I decided to kind of not go that far back in history just for reasons of space.
That I can understand.
But right.
Let's take you through a few of the time periods, and you can give us some other examples. Let's take, for example, before 1700. What would be your favorite?
What I find really intriguing from before 1700 is so-called Letter of Prester John. And this occurred in the 12th century. And it was at the time of the Crusades when the Christian armies were fighting the Muslim armies. And this rumor started to circulate around Europe about this fabulously wealthy, powerful Christian king who lived in the East, whose name was Prester John. And the idea was that maybe Prester John could come to the aid of the Christian armies and finally help defeat the Muslims, because actually the Crusades were going somewhat badly for the church at that time. So this started out as a rumor, but then in around 1164, an actual letter appeared from this character, Prester John. And this letter began to circulate around all the courts in Europe. And in this letter, Prester John described his incredibly, you know, almost miraculously wealthy kingdom, where he even said that he had a spring in his kingdom that conferred eternal life and eternal youth on the drinker of this water. And, you know, all the Christian rulers reading this just couldn't believe their luck. You know, they thought, oh, my God, you know, our prayers have been answered. We're going to finally defeat the Muslims. And, in fact, for centuries, the idea of Prester John after this letter kind of haunted the European imagination. And whenever European explorers would go out searching in the Far East, they would always try to find this magical kingdom of Prester John, which of course didn't exist. And now we can look back on this and see that the letter must obviously have been written by some, probably a cleric in one of the European courts who was trying to create and give legitimacy to this this fiction of this Eastern king, probably to help raise the hopes of the various Christian soldiers.
So this hoax, maybe like others from an earlier period, wasn't proven false at any particular point, but just over the course of years it became clear that Prester John didn't exist.
Yeah, what's interesting is that before you have the creation of public audiences and critical public audiences in around the 18th century, you don't really have any of these major deceptions exposed. So they would linger on for centuries just in the popular imagination. And it was only really when you have a kind of reading critical public in the 18th century that this idea of exposing these deceptions becomes more popular. And actually it was around the 18th century that really hoaxes become to take on a new form of being almost kind of like dramatic performances directed towards the public, whereas before they had just mostly been people trying to get away with something, you know, more species of fraud than an actual dramatic performance, which is what they become later.
Okay, well, give us an example from the 18th century.
One of the ones I like is called The Predictions of Isaac Bickerstaff. And what this was an astrologer, supposedly named Isaac Bickerstaff, published a series of predictions in early 1708, predicting that one of his rival astrologers, a man named John Partridge, was going to die that year on March 29th. And, of course, John Partridge took some offense to this and, you know, published a rival announcement saying, you know, this is baloney. I'm not going to die on March 29th. In fact, he had a little phrase. He said that Bickerstaff's whole design is nothing but deceit. The end of March will show the cheat. And but then March 29th came around, and Bickerstaff published a second announcement saying, you know, guess what? I was right. John Partridge has just died. So, you know, I was proven to be the better astrologer. And this kind of circulated around London. And, in fact, after a couple of days, on April 1st, in fact, the authorities gathered outside Partridge's house to arrange his funeral. And they happened to wake up Partridge, who was asleep and still very much alive, who was then reduced to having to publicly protest that he was not, in fact, dead. He was still alive, but you know, at that point, the entire public thought that he was in fact dead. It was kind of like, you know, I think there's a Monty Python skit of somebody being hauled off to the grave and protesting that he's not dead yet. And this was a kind of humiliating situation that Partridge was reduced to. And what it turned out to be was that Isaac Bickerstaff was in fact the writer Jonathan Swift, who was trying to mock and publicly humiliate this astrologer who he thought was just full of, you know, of bunk and deserved to be humiliated publicly. So in that sense, you can see that was a very public performance on Swift's part, trying to, you know, expose this astrologer publicly as a kind of charlatan.
And how appropriate to do it on April 1st, April
Fool's Day. Exactly, and that actually happens to be probably the earliest recorded April Fool's Day prank in history.
I love it. That's great. How about the 19th century?
When you get to the 19th century, of course, you have the creation of the mass market newspapers, the penny press. So, you know, hoaxes really take on a whole new public, a whole new aspect of public performance. And one I really like was the so-called Great Moon Hoax of 1835. And some of the background context here was that a lot of astronomers believed that the moon probably was inhabited. And the reason for this is that their telescopes back then really were not very good. So a lot of astronomers would kind of squint up at the moon, and they thought that maybe they could see roads and fortifications and cities on the moon. So it was a very widely held belief that the moon was inhabited. So this New York newspaper, the New York Sun, publishes a story that it claims it got this news from a European scientific journal, which it had somehow obtained an advanced copy of, saying that, in fact, a famous British astronomer has constructed a giant new telescope which has allowed him to confirm the existence of life on the moon. And they then proceeded to describe this fabulous life that existed on the moon. You know, there were lunar unicorns and supposedly biped beavers who had mastered the use of fire, and that the crowning discovery on the moon was a race of humans who had wings and flew around and actually kind of engaged in somewhat unseemly behavior. Apparently they didn't have the proper, you know, moral guidance of the Christian church on the moon, so their behavior was a bit indecent. But this all fascinated the New York reading public, and for almost really a couple of weeks, this news spread around America and just created this huge sensation that finally life has been discovered in the universe. But it turned out, of course, that the New York Sun had made the entire thing up, and what it was really trying to do was to fool its rival newspapers into printing this ridiculous story and believing it so that it would show how much smarter it was than all its newspaper rivals out there. Mm-hmm. And it definitely succeeded. It went on the basis of the moon hoax, it became probably one of the most famous papers in the world and, you know, lasted for well over a century as one of the great newspapers of the Western world. And, in fact, it's been revived recently, so the New York Sun still exists as a paper.
Well, I dare say, listening to late-night radio, that hoax still exists, but
right.
What about the 20th century, kind of quickly?
Probably the most famous hoax of the 20th century would be the Orson Welles' War of the Worlds broadcast, and some people claim that this actually isn't a hoax. What it was in October 1938, when Orson Welles put on a radio play of a dramatic broadcast of H.G. Wells's War of the Worlds story in which Martians attack the Earth. And supposedly thousands of people throughout America heard this broadcast and thought that Martians really were attacking the Earth and just panicked and got into their cars. People argue that it isn't really a hoax because Orson Welles wasn't really trying to fool people. And when you listen to the broadcast today, it's clearly a play to modern ears. But on the other hand, I think he was trying to, add as much reality to this to his performance as possible. So I think he did have a kind of hope that some people would be fooled by the broadcast. But on the other, there's an element of a hoax in it, in that there's now a question of how many people really were fooled by this, and did the media kind of drum up the entire story of this enormous panic? And did this panic really happen in the way it's been reported? So there is a hoax element there. But whatever the case, the War of the Worlds has come to symbolize the huge power that the mass media was obtaining over the public in the 20th century with radio and movies and TV that would come later.
Well, it certainly has. But have hoaxes changed at all as we now enter into the 21st century?
Well, the great change has been the advent of the rise of the Internet. And what this has done is really democratized the potential for hoaxing. And previously, you really had to have access to a media outlet in somehow in order to perpetrate a big hoax. You had to somehow be working for a newspaper, as in the case of the Great Moon hoax, or have access to a radio station, as in the War of the Worlds. But with the Internet, what's happened is that anybody with access to a computer terminal, and that now includes pretty much anybody who can get to a public library, can start one of these, can start spreading a lie and potentially reach an audience of millions. So in the past 10 years, you've just seen this explosion in hoaxing.
Can you give me one example?
one famous one from 1994, really kind of the beginning of the internet, was a hoax called Microsoft Buys the Catholic Church. And what this was an email that started to spread around that looked like a press release claiming that Microsoft had actually just bought the Catholic Church. And as part of this deal, Microsoft was gaining exclusive electronic rights to the Bible, and it was also developing the ability to deliver the sacraments online. And it was all kind of very satirical, and most people recognized it as satire, but enough people were fooled by it that Microsoft actually felt compelled to issue an official denial that no, you know, they were not actually buying the Catholic Church. But what it really signaled was the power that the internet was obtaining as a form of mass communication, because this press release spread around the world without the traditional media playing any role in it at all, and it really kind of took the media by surprise how far this thing had spread on its own.
Okay, well, you have many, many different hoaxes that are enjoyable to read about in your book, but you also have a virtual museum of hoaxes.
That's right.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Right. I have a website, www.museumofhoaxes.com, and I kind of like to use the website now to put all the various hoaxes that basically didn't fit in the book, because there's so many. There's thousands of these hoaxes out there, and obviously a book only has a limited amount of space, so on the website I collect all the ones that didn't fit in the book, but I also have a few more interactive features, such as I have a hoax photo test on the website where people can try to guess which are the hoax photographs and which are the real photographs, and that's been pretty popular. And I also have a long list of websites that are actually hoaxes, not websites about hoaxes, but websites that actually are hoaxes themselves.
Interesting. Well, you've got a great topic here, and the book is good, and I would certainly recommend that people visit your virtual museum. It's a great idea.
Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you for joining us, Alex.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Alex Berza, author of Museum of Hoaxes, published by Dutton Books. And you can visit Alex's virtual Museum of Hoaxes at www.museumofhoaxes.com. This is Talking History.
They're talking to Allah, they're talking to themselves, man, no, they're talking to Elvis. You know what's going on, that Bermuda Triangle, down the Bermuda Triangle. Elvis needs boats. Ah, the sailing Elvis, Captain Elvis, Commodore Elvis it is. Yeah, man, you know, people from outer space, they come up to me. They don't look like Dr. Spock. They don't look like Klingons, all that Star Trek jive. They look like Elvis. Everybody in outer space looks like Elvis, because Elvis is a perfect being. We're all moving in perfect peace and harmony towards Elvis-ness. Soon all will become Elvis. Everything, everywhere will be Elvis. Why do you think they call it evolution anyway? It's really Elvis-lution.
On the morning of February 1st, the space shuttle Columbia disintegrated while re-entering the Earth's atmosphere. The tragic loss of life reinvigorated the debate about the future of NASA, as well as the role of human beings in space. Here to offer some historical perspective on that debate is Jonathan Coopersmith, professor of history at Texas A&M University.
Can we boldly go there anymore? Space is dangerous and, consequently, expensive. That first fact was brought painfully home February 1st as the space shuttle Columbia disintegrated while re-entering the Earth's atmosphere. The second fact will be relearned if we reassess, as we should, NASA's goals and the role of people in space. cost, not risk, may prove the decisive factor. Though any loss of life is tragic, what is impressive about 42 years of human exploration of space is not how many astronauts and cosmonauts have died, but how few. Far more people die during the early years of developing airplanes than in shuttle accidents, because the very high cost of space exploration has meant that only the American and Soviet governments could afford to send people into space. Consequently, manned spacecraft were designed and closely monitored to ensure the crew's safety. Failures, however, are part of the human condition. After previous failures, NASA has created committees to discover why they occurred and how to fix them. These studies changed how NASA operated, but did not provoke a larger discussion about goals, in part because of larger political concerns, like winning the space race. Unlike previous space disasters, the choices we face are less influenced by international political considerations, and thus can be made on their own merits. As well as understanding why Columbia disintegrated, we should also ask the very appropriate question about what should be the role of people in space. Since it successfully landed men on the moon on July 20, 1969, NASA's space program has been in search of a mission to justify itself. To go boldly where no person has gone before is a stirring and worthy aspiration, but space exploration is extremely expensive. Each shuttle mission costs $500 million, and half of NASA's $15 billion budget goes to human space activities. In contrast, the entire budget for the National Science Foundation is $5 billion. Most opponents of manned spaceflight do not object to the goals of people living and working in space, but to the great expense. They view those billions of dollars as money that could be more productively and efficiently spent elsewhere. Robotic satellites can do much in space at far less cost than sending people into orbit. The historical analogies of colonizing the Americas after Columbus and the expansion of aviation are often used to justify human exploration of space. Such analogies fail to take into account the decades needed for technologies to evolve and their cost to drop. Despite government promotion, it took generations of technological evolution before commercial aviation could operate successfully and profitably. Space exploration may be at the same stage today. Costly, not defective technology is its most serious challenge.
You've been listening to Jonathan Cooper Smith, Professor of History of Science and Technology at Texas A&M University and the author of The Electrification of Russia, 1880 to 1926. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. As always, we welcome your comments or suggestions, either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beattie, assistant producer. You can learn more about Talking History and the Organization of American Historians at oah.org. Until next week, this is your host, Brian Laveau.
Oh, yeah, I can see the thing's body now. It's large. It's large as a bear. It's glistening like wet leather, but that face, ladies and gentlemen, it's indescribable. I can hardly force myself to keep looking at it. It's so awful. The eyes are black and they gleam like a serpent. The mouth is a kind of V-shape with saliva dripping from its rimless lips that seem to, quiver and pulsate.